good Thursday morning to you, and welcome into Darren and Donick here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Darren McFarland, that's me. Steve Lehman, News Channel 5. Well, it'll be you as soon as we turn you on. Yeah, let's turn his mic on. There we go.
Is it this one?
There we go.
It is that one. Okay. We're all discombobulated over here.
That's Steve.
That's me. Now.
That's you. You take two. Ready? Action.
I picked up the microphone closest to me. That was not the right one.
Things get shuffled sometimes
Here
at Barrel House. That's where we are inside Bridgestone Arena. You know what that means tonight, the Predators' home game, and they are hosting the Montreal Canadiens. Former captain and now current captain of Montreal, Shea Weber, is in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Actually saw him downstairs. Good to see Shea Weber. He is definitely one of the good guys.
He give you a hug? Do anything like, yeah. Really say good to see you, D-Mac?
He is that type of guy. I mean, I don't know about hug.
Yeah.
But he's that type.
Yes. Hug seemed like a reach. He's not a man of a lot of words, and so I think sometimes people mistake that for being kind of a gruff person, and he's not that.
Oh, no.
He's a very good guy.
Actually, he's not a man of few words if you talk anything but hockey to him. Actually,
that's exactly right.
You can get him going and talk for a very, very
long
time.
You want to talk baseball, the Toronto Blue
dogs,
Jays, something like that? Oh, he'll
family,
go in.
Family, I mean, you know, dad, being a dad, family life, dogs, his big – massive dogs, baseball, any of his hot button issues, actually, he'll talk your head off. I've had some great conversations with Shea over the years about anything and everything, and it hardly ever has anything to do with hockey. In fact, this time last year, or whenever the Canadiens came to town last year, I was standing on the corner here at 5th and, what would that be, 5th and Demumbrian.
Yep.
And I was walking to the arena for pregame, and I felt somebody tap my shoulder, and, you know, I just figured somebody, you know, Preds fan or whatever, somebody I
sure
knew, buddy, turned around. It was Shea. And I said, well, I guess you're not playing tonight. He said, nope. And I said, so how are things going? And, you know, he's like, not great. He was dealing with the injuries.
Right.
And, you know, I could tell just talking hockey with him. He just – and the minute I switched gears, I mean, I had to say, Shea, it's great. I'd love to sit here long. I got to go. I got to go do
– I
have
a show
to the arena. Yeah, I mean, once I switched over to everything else, then, you know, he lit up like a Christmas tree. But he was also, you know, the Canadians were struggling. He was dealing with injuries. And, you know, shortly after that, they shut him down for the year. And obviously he's back and things are great. Montreal has 69 points on the year, and Shea Weber has 9 goals, 12 assists, 21 points, and he's a plus 16. So he's having a really good year for Montreal. But he's a great dude. Not surprising, because you know you've been in these rooms enough. I mean, David Poile is notorious. It's so easy to root for this team once you get to be around these guys and spend any time around them, because are all of them choir boys over the years, over 20-plus years now? No. Have they all been choir? No. But overall, the majority, most, they're incredibly likable human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And he is in a long – but Shea Weber is up at the top. The guys that are just good, solid human beings, good people, and happens to be a great hockey player.
And I think he deserves a lot of credit for what the Predators are now. You know, unfortunately for him, he hasn't been here for the greatest run of success over the last few years. But the long-term tenure he had as the captain, I think probably is undersold how much of an impact he had on that room in establishing a culture. Because you don't build the culture they have in that room right now. You don't build that overnight. That wasn't something that just like happened in April 2 years ago when they went on the way to the Stanley Cup final and now it's just there. That's something that was built over a long period of time, and David Poile's got a lot to do with it. I think Barry Trotz has a lot to do with what went on in that locker room, and certainly Shea Weber's part of it. And now this group has just built off of it and now had some incredible success.
Yeah, honestly, getting to know him so well over the years, it frustrated me, because I felt like, you know, the fan base, the audience was getting cheated because they didn't he rarely, I mean, he was great about doing things. It was kind of like the Steve McNair effect. Steve McNair just knew he was a pro. He was an NFL quarterback. If he never had to do an interview, he would totally be fine with that and would actually prefer that.
Right.
But he understood the job at hand, and he was a pro. And Steve McNair got up there with a smile on his face, and he did it. Okay? He did it because he knew that was part of the job. And Shea Weber is the same way. I think the frustrating part for me is I knew how much more there was to give when it came to an interview setting. And I could pull it out of him sometimes. But most of the whole body of work overall, I feel like most people didn't really get to capture, you know, the Shea Weber that could really open up. And toward the end, that's why I'll never forget, I mean, I had a great conversation with individually with Roman Yossi and with Shea Weber. It shocked the you-know-what out of me whenever, you know, that was kind of the start of the Predators realizing that fans want more access, right? And we were starting to see it in sports, and that's why Jerry built that palace in Dallas, and it's about the team walking through and, you know, shake it right through the fans. It was about access to these guys. And in professional sports, they realize that fans want more. They want access. They want to know more about these players. And that's when the Predators started doing more and more on their website. And, you know, that's where Thomas Willis and Brooks Bratton, that's created. And there's all this insights, videos. And Shea Weber, if you remember, went out on the concourse with Roman Yossi, and they just went out there as like reporters and just walked up to random people. And it was hilarious. And it was great. But what floored me is that I had to do a double take and say, Shea Weber did that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's just not him.
That's not him.
That's
but he was great at it.
He was great. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I knew he would be great at it, but he didn't want to do that stuff. He didn't.
Sure.
I knew he was more than capable of doing that.
He doesn't love the spotlight.
No.
He just likes to play hockey, and he likes to talk about other things in life. He doesn't love the spotlight that comes with it. I'm glad you bring all that up, because I would say in my 8 years in Nashville, one of the people at the top of the list for me in terms of, man, I wish I had an opportunity to sit them down and do 10 minutes or whatever with them and kind of peel back all the layers of the onion to try to give it to fans. You know, because that's something I try to do. I try to find those people who are interesting beyond what the fan typically knows and try to bring that to them at some point. Shea would maybe be at the top of the list for me in terms of interviews that I wish I could have done in that style and never got the chance to do. Because I do think he's that fascinating of a guy with a lot of different interests. And what you got from him is you got the standard captain lines. You know, tough loss tonight. We've got to do this, or we've got to go back to the drawing board or whatever. Or, man, big win, really proud of this team, whatever. You got that. And he stepped up to the plate and did that whenever he was asked to do it. But there is so much more there, and I wish Predators fans, by and large, knew more about that.
Yeah. But they are in town tonight, and the Predators will hit the road after tonight. They'll be in Vegas Saturday night and then Dallas on Tuesday evening before returning home. So this is the last home game before a couple of road games here in the middle of February. Happy Valentine's Day, by the way, to everybody out there. Got a chance to check out as we wrap up this first segment. We'll have Richard Deitch from The Athletic on the other side. Vols took care of business against South Carolina. South Carolina, no surprise, just would not go away. Typical Frank Martin team. And then watch Vanderbilt scratch and claw for most of the game down in Gainesville against Florida before falling by 9 points. My takeaway from the Vanderbilt game is Bryce Drew has got to figure out how to fill up his roster with guys like Neesmith. That's the guy. To me, that everything else, and I know everything that's gone on this year, I want guys that have his attitude, what he brings to the table night in and night out, his enthusiasm, his will to want to win, and just from what I can see, not being around him, just watching him on the court, I would want my roster full of Neesmiths. That's me.
Yeah, I agree. A coaching buddy of mine's kid was the point guard on his high school team last year in Charleston, South Carolina. And he said, I realize that he's not the highest rated recruit in this Vanderbilt class, but Vanderbilt fans are going to love Aaron Nesmith. And I think that is absolutely proving to be the case. He maybe took a little longer at the beginning of the year because he just isn't the natural talent that some of these other high recruits are, but he's a ball player. And he was the Gatorade Player of the Year in South Carolina last year over Zion Williamson. Think about that for a second.
Wow.
So he's a really, really good player that I think has a very bright future at Vanderbilt. There's other talent on that team. It still goes back to me that the Garland loss is just so huge because he was the one guy that was alpha male or captain, whatever you want to call it. He's the one guy that when they get into the position of all these games where it's a tight game at the end of the – you want the ball in his hands, and he's the guy that would help you get a stop on the defensive end. He's the guy who would set up somebody or take the shot on the offensive end, and we saw that in brief stints early in the year. He won them that game at USC, I think it was, early on, where he just took over late. That is what this team needs, and they put themselves in that position time and time again where it's, you know, 60-55 or 58-58 with 2 or 3 minutes to go, and that's where you need that guy. And Saban Lee, as good of a player and scorer as he is, he's not that guy. And they've just missed it all season long.
Yeah, I would fill up that roster. I would find guys that bring everything to the table like Nesmith. That's what I would be looking for if I were Bryce Drew. I mean, when he hit that three-pointer and got fouled in the first half, and the way he was screaming and jumping up like he just won the game, I want a guy that has that attitude.
Yep.
Because that tells me that's a guy that's still fighting and scratching and clawing and trying to win, and they sit now 0-11 in conference play. Like I said, that's the guy I want going to battle for me every night.
I know we've got to go break, but real quickly, he reminds me a little bit of all the guys that make Tennessee so good.
Yep.
And when they were his age, Tennessee wasn't that good, were they? They were fighting and scrapping and clawing, and you were like, gosh, I like that Grant Williams player, but they're not very good yet. You know what? They just grew and they matured and they came together, and now they're the best team in the country because they've all come together. That's the hope if you're Bryce Drew and Roger Powell and everybody over there, that this team, as they get older, continues to do that.
We'll come back. We'll have a discussion with Richard Deitch from The Athletic. We do that next on Darren Adonik, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Back here on Darren and Donick here inside Bridgestone Arena. Predators and Canadians tonight. Darren McFarland, Steve Lehman, News Channel 5 alongside Willie D will join us in a bit. I was telling Steve about our final hour of the show yesterday. In studio, we had Julie Turris, who is the wife of Kyle Turris, and Ida, who is the Ida Bjornstad. And it's really
there
more like Bjornstad, but, you know, I'm going to mess it up because I'm not Swedish.
We anglicize everything over here.
She's the fiance of Matthias Ekholm, and they did an hour with us. They're doing a podcast together, Ida and Julie. Off the Ice is the podcast, and they were fantastic. I would encourage anybody who didn't hear the last hour of the show yesterday to go back and check it out on our website, on our SoundCloud, because it is really, really good radio for the final hour of the show. Let's bring in Richard Deitch, who's up in Toronto. His work can be found on The Athletic. Richard, how you doing?
Speaking of the opposite of good radio, how are you guys?
Not at all. And by the way, I thought of you because that, you know, you're so diverse and you do so many things. And I thought, man, that was an hour probably Richard would have loved to have been a part of, you know, because you love to delve into kind of the other side of things. Willie and I absolutely loved it. We'll do it again with them. They're enjoying doing the podcast, and it's always interesting, right? You know the husbands for their work on the ice in the sport or the sport they play on the playing surface, but rarely do you know life behind the scenes, and that's what you get with them, and I thought it was fascinating.
Well, two things there. One, anytime you can, or at least I should sort of speak for myself, but just the business of podcasting is interesting to me and how people decide to do one. What they talk about, how their chemistry is. And then for the specific one that you talked about, we see so many sports podcasts that are NBA-centric in particular. There's a lot of NFL ones out there. Let's float down, obviously, some baseball ones. The one sport or a major sport that I think still there's a lot of room and growth in the U.S. in terms of podcasting is hockey. So any of these offshoots, whether it's current players, whether it's wives of current players, whether it's former players, there's a big audience still to be had, because that is one sport that, at least in my opinion, anecdotally, still is a bit underserved.
Yeah, and it's interesting, if you know Kyle Turris, he's a fantastic hockey player and a super nice guy, but doesn't have a whole lot to say. When I first heard about it, and I joked with his wife yesterday about it, I'm like, really? Kyle Turris's wife? And then you meet Julie, and you're like, oh, yeah, I get it. And then when I asked her if he gives her if he critiques her podcast, and she said yes, and I said, what does he say? He says that I talk too much, and I need to let Ida talk more. So we had a lot of fun with that. If I asked you, because the Raptors and the Maple Leafs have made trades, they are positioning themselves for their playoff pushes, and they are two very good teams in their sports. You're up there. If I were to ask you today, who's gonna last longer, what would your answer be?
That's a good question. I think so much of the answer to that question, honestly, is going to be who each of the teams draw. But my initial answer would be watch out for the second round for both teams, because that's sort of really where the rubber meets the road. I think they'll both win their first round matchups, and then the second round is the tricky one. I think today I would say the Raps, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me if the Leafs made it further. It certainly wouldn't surprise me if both teams lost. But I do think if everybody can sort of come back healthy, and if they have a couple games at the end of the regular season to put it together, Toronto's really deep now with the additions of Marcus Saul, Jeremy Lin, and they should be tough in the playoffs. That said, anybody who follows the NBA, if they've seen Milwaukee, they've been the best Eastern Conference team this year, and the Sixers and Celtics are going to be really, really tough out. So all of a sudden, the Eastern Conference in the last 6 months in the NBA has gotten really, really interesting because of all the additions. But that's a good question. It's going to be a very, very fun spring in Toronto, and that will make up for the Toronto Blue Jays, who should be spectacularly awful in 2019.
You talking with us and what it was like, and you watched it from afar, the run to the Stanley Cup final was like in this city, where it just consumed this market, and hockey took over this market and took over downtown. It was a crazy, crazy sight to see, and their fan base grew exponentially through that run to the Stanley Cup final. I realize Toronto is a much bigger market, but what if, because you're there, the Raptors were to represent the Eastern Conference in the NBA Finals, and the Leafs were to represent the Eastern Conference in the Stanley Cup final, what would that city be like if both teams were at the end?
You watch Game of Thrones at all?
I do not.
I do. Right, I know what you're talking about.
All right, so there you go. So basically it'd be like the White Walkers basically going to attack everybody. It would be waves and waves of people on the streets looking to eat you. It would be – I can't – the reality is, to be serious, the Leafs one would be the far more significant one. This is a hockey town. It's a hockey country. And if Toronto, which is essentially the epicenter of the NHL, at least in Canada, could make the Stanley Cup, now they haven't won since, I think, 67. So if they can make the Cup, I can't even imagine what the coverage and what the intensity of that would be. If both teams could make it, that would be unbelievable. I think it would, the one thing, obviously, this is a world-class city, and anybody who's gone to Toronto knows it's kind of an amazing place. It feels like whatever, one of these world cities, London, Madrid, New York. But I think it would change the perception of how, especially U.S. sports fans see Toronto, if both teams would be in the final. Because, it's not in the U.S., so it's sort of always thought of this kind of oddity. But if you had both teams in the finals with all that U.S. television coverage, it would be really interesting to see the reaction. I will tell you this, the networks I don't think would want it, because if you're ABC and it's, Raptors, Golden State, you get no benefit from the Toronto television market because it's in Canada, and the same for NBC if it was like the Maple Leafs, Predators. You wouldn't you know, Toronto doesn't count in the Nielsen ratings. So I don't think the American television networks would be rooting for it. But man, it would be incredible to be in this city when that happened. And the reality is, they have a real shot. I think you'd have to bet against it just on the odds. But you know, it is a legitimate thing that could happen.
Speaking of ABC, you brought them up. They have announced that ESPN/ABC is going to carry 2 hours of the combine. The underwear party is going to be on national television. What do you think of that?
I mean, can there get anything more exciting than to see men working out on the field in their shorts and T-shirts? I mean, we're talking about like some of the most compelling television that exists. I'm not surprised. The fact is, the NFL Network has proven, and successfully so, that there's big demand for any pre-draft programming, including the scouting combine. And, you know, we're talking, you guys know this better than me, but, you know, mid-February, early March, on a Saturday, there is not much to be put on in terms of network television when it comes to sports. So it actually is like a pretty smart move for ABC to put that on, see what kind of viewership they'll get. The NFL obviously is ecstatic because it gets them on a network as opposed to the NFL Network. And then the larger thing about all this, and this is sort of the largest story when you bring up the scouting combine, and that is the ESPN relationship with the NFL, because that's what this is all about. ESPN has spent the last 10 months, basically, their executives trying to form a better relationship with the NFL because it was not very good under the former president, John Skipper. And so you're seeing ESPN/ABC getting some more interesting access, doing some more interesting things. And what this is ultimately, at least in terms of if you're ABC, their hope is that when the next round of NFL media rights deals come up, they would really like to get in the Super Bowl rotation. That is sort of that's their ultimate dream. And so they're doing everything they can to sort of to get a better relationship with the NFL. From the NFL's perspective, I think they should do it personally because, one, you're going to get a ton more money from ESPN ABC if you get them in the Super Bowl. And, two, the one thing you'll say about ESPN is if ABC ever got a Super Bowl, I mean, ESPN, if you think ESPN overmarkets stuff now, they'll be marketing that Super Bowl for like seven months before it happens. So. Yep. I think it'd be smart for the NFL. Obviously, ESPN, ABC would love it. And I would say I would put it at 50-50 right now. I could totally see that. NBC, Fox, CBS, they're not going to be happy because it would sort of still, they'd skip a year. But I think that's going to happen. So So the scouting combine is one thing, but it really is a larger story, and the larger story is the relationship between ESPN and the NFL.
You're saying ESPN would have a 72-hour Super Bowl pregame show?
That's
entirely
possible.
Honestly, ESPN would have a 37-year pregame show. It would, even though this is probably impossible, it would start in 1979, and then it would just go until – yes, I think, honestly, as you guys know, ESPN has a massive marketing machine. If they ever had the Super Bowl, my God. I actually think they would basically hologram Stephen A. Smith into 50 different people and just have him on every ESPN network talking about the upcoming Super Bowl. He, of course, would probably, since he's not really big, really know much about football, he'd probably have incorrect information, but yeah. It doesn't matter regardless. They just put it out there. And it'd be PR.
I was just going to say, just don't ask him to do any matchups during that time. Richard Deitch covers the media for The Athletic, joins us here on 102.5 The Game. Another sport that would love to increase its exposure desperately. I think we talked to you about this in the fall, Richard, is about how NASCAR in the last decade or so has actually lost more viewers. They've lost more viewers in the last decade than they have left. So as they get set for the Daytona 500 this weekend, the Super Bowl of stock car racing, what are you looking for from their broadcast and their presentation, and can they save this at this point?
Well, I think if you're NASCAR, I think really your goal is to sort of you just hold on to the viewers that you have. I wouldn't sort of use the phrase save it because I don't think the sport's going anywhere. You're still talking about 3.5 million people who watch it every weekend. So, you know, that'd be hard for the sport to go. I just think of how many sports have far less viewers that are around. But it's a real, you know, they got a real issue. And I'm not sure what the solution is. I remember when I was at Sports Illustrated, I got this assignment. I think it was like the year 2000 or 2001 where I went to 7 NASCAR races over 8 weeks, and it was awesome. It was just, like, really, really interesting, and it totally blew up all my stereotypes about NASCAR. And if you guys remember how many stories were written at that time of, like, how hot NASCAR is, and it's kind of like the next great sport in terms of sort of blowing up nationally, that's all gone. Like, that world does not exist anymore. So I think if you're NASCAR, you're just going to try your best to sort of maintain the market you have, but I don't really know, you know, I can't say I watch it every week, so I don't really know what the solution is. I do know that they lost a lot of viewers because the playoff system got pretty complicated. They've obviously lost in the last 5 years some major, major figures like Dale Jr. and Jeff Gordon and Tony Stewart, but I don't know. I mean, I wish I could answer your question better. I don't see any kind of catalyst to bring new fans in. I guess I would say with one caveat, and if they could ever get like a Tiger Woods-like figure, a driver of color to be a mega star, I think that could be a game changer. Or maybe like a woman like a Danica Patrick figure, but somebody who won consistently. But outside of that, I don't see it. I think if you're NASCAR, I think you do your best to hold on to the 3 million people that are watching you every week, and you do everything you can to support them, because you are right. That trend is going and has been going in the wrong direction now for a decade.
Richard, I've got a question about two different broadcasters and their exits from their past employers now. I'll lump them into one, I guess. I know they're different, but for time purposes. One, Bob Costas and his departure from NBC. We knew it's coming. It's played out over a while, but especially with the Super Bowl dust-up and not being uninvited, I guess. Was that as spectacularly bad as it sort of has been played out in the media for how that all ended after that wonderful long-term relationship? And then Adnan Virk, who to me was an absolute rising star at ESPN and now is out unceremoniously. What can you say about both of those two?
Yeah, I mean, two very different situations, obviously. I mean, the Costas one, I think it just sort of feels like it's fresh because of the E60 report this weekend and the big story by Mark Fenerwada. But, you know, he had really separated himself from NBC over the course of a couple of years. And the real news peg here, of course, is that he was basically pulled off the Super Bowl coverage because of his comments outside of NBC about the NFL's nexus and relationship with brain injuries. So that one, while it might feel like, in the public, like, oh my God, sort of so spectacular, that's really just because the C60 story came out. But that separation had been going on for a while. And but you are correct in just that, like, we're not going to see Bob Costas again on NBC. And that's a weird one, just because he was the face of NBC Sports. The Virk one, obviously, totally, totally different. You are correct. And absolutely, I think, terrific broadcaster at ESPN who could do so much stuff. Someone who is, you know, I personally know him, so a really terrific guy, smart, I think a very loyal soldier to ESPN. And then obviously he has this incident where the network accuses him of leaking a story to Awful Announcing. And this is sort of where it gets, at least for me, a little bit dicey. ESPN's punishment or ESPN's discipline, the one thing that's consistent about it is it's always inconsistent.
Yeah.
So I think where they ultimately terminated him was because of their evaluation of him being uncooperative after they found him leaking information to a story. Found him leaking information off Awful Announcing. So two things there. One, I think you got to make the punishment sort of determinant of what was the information given out. And two, what kind of employee was this? And Virk was a phenomenal employee. So to me, I think he deserved a suspension without pay, however many days you think it should be, 30 days, whatever, without termination. And then lastly, and again, some will disagree with my take here, and I readily admit I am more akin to be signing with Adnan Virk than ESPN, but your entire network has a business model where every single day, people leak things to Adam Schefter, Jeff Passan, Adrian Wojnarowski, Brian Windhorst. Look on ESPN.com's website every day. Sources tell ESPN blank. So because you're in that business, I would like to think that you would be a little, I don't know, more understanding, even if you are not happy about it, with what Virk did. And ultimately, the information he gave out was meaningless. Didn't affect ESPN's bottom line at all. So I would have liked to have seen them give him a suspension as opposed to a termination. They decided otherwise, and now, like everything else in the world, the lawyers have at it.
Richard, good stuff as always. Appreciate the visit. Have a great rest of your week, and we'll do it again next week.
You got it. See you guys.
Richard Deitch from The Athletic. That's where his work can be found. We'll come back with more of Darren and Donnick next. Back here on Darren and Donnick, ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're here at Bridgestone Arena, Predators and Canadians. Tonight at 7 o'clock, pregame at 6. Everything heard right here on 102.5 The Game. We'll talk to Trent Dilfer, who has moved to Nashville to become a high school football coach at Lipscomb. We're going to talk to him at noon. We're excited about that. Colby Armstrong at 1 o'clock. We'll talk a little bit more about this matchup tonight. And in the final hour, we will give you a chance to win tickets to tonight's game. So we'll do that all coming up at 1 o'clock. Lindsey Rowley will join us here at the desk a little bit later in the second hour. We were talking about some of the SEC games last night. Another one that jumped out at me was, how about Kermit Davis and Ole Miss? The Rebels go to Auburn and hold them to their lowest point total of the year, 55 points. And, oh, by the way, the lowest point total before that for Auburn this year was their matchup earlier in Oxford against Ole Miss. So the Rebels have held the Auburn Tigers to their lowest games of the year when they play them. So great job by Kermit Davis and the Rebels. That was a heck of a win, 60-55. I believe Auburn averages like, what, 82 points a game, something like that, and they held them to 55 at their place.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. I think perhaps the two most surprising teams for me this year in the SEC, when I think about it, Ole Miss is now 17-7, 7-4 in the league, when a lot of people had them picked dead last, near the bottom of the league at the beginning of the year. So incredible job that Kermit Davis has done in a short time there. And then Auburn, who was the co-champion last year with Tennessee and had a good chunk of that team coming back. I mean, a lot of people thought when you looked at the league this year, it was going to be Tennessee and Kentucky and Auburn in some order at the top of the league. And here Auburn is now below 500, 11 games through the league. So I still think Auburn's a tournament team and they'll get there at the end of the day. But I think they've been disappointing this year, and I can't say enough about the job that Kermit's done with Ole Miss in year one.
I don't think anybody saw. I mean, as much as we were huge fans, and the two of us talked with him shortly after he got down to Oxford and was sworn in as Ole Miss's next head basketball coach, you know, huge fans of Kermit Davis and his work down in Murfreesboro at Middle. But I don't think anybody saw this coming. I mean, they're obviously they're 100% a tournament team, and can they make some noise? I don't know why not.
If you can go down there and do that last night and play that type of defense, and that's the thing that's most impressive to me. He's got some guys like Brian Tyree is a really, really good player, and he was there.
Yeah.
So it doesn't surprise me that he can go for 25 in a game and help you compete with somebody or even help you win. But what's really been impressive to me is the way they've locked some people down. They've run into that 2-3 zone that they've put out on people, and they've extended sometimes where it looks more like a 1-3-1, and oh my gosh, that's given a lot of people fits, and they've really been able to get stops. It is the example to me of a team totally reflecting the personality of their head coach, and oftentimes that's difficult to do in year one. He's somehow made that happen. They look like some of his veteran teams at Middle Tennessee and how they represent him on the floor already just 23 or 24 games into his tenure, whatever it is.
So now with Tennessee's victory last night over South Carolina, it is setting up, and Kentucky's stinging loss to LSU, it is setting up the matchup Saturday night in Rupp Arena in Lexington. 7 o'clock is when they'll tip it off, Nashville time. And, it, I mean, I can't wait. I think it's going to be fantastic. It's one of at least two that we know of. Who knows if they'll have a third matchup here? Who knows if they'll have a fourth matchup down the road in the NCAA tournament? I mean, it could play out that way. We know, though, they're going to play twice, and it starts Saturday in Lexington. The final meeting will be in Knoxville, and I'm curious to see how a Kentucky team that's ranked fifth in the country versus Tennessee, who's ranked first, and how that looks in Rupp Arena on Saturday night.
And remember, Tennessee went in there and won last year. It was a huge win for them there, so they're capable of going in and doing that for sure. What's going to be interesting to me over the next few weeks is I think we have a good idea of what Tennessee is, but I think we get a really good idea in the next few weeks because during this 19-game winning streak, they haven't had a whole lot of, especially in SEC play, haven't had a whole lot of games where they've really been challenged. I mean, think about it. Last night, South Carolina hit 14 threes. 14 threes.
And lost by
double
digits.
Yeah. That is where Tennessee is right now against a lot of this field. And I think what that says is they're really good. They don't have to play their best to beat you, and you have to play absolutely your best to have a shot. But now here over the next three Saturdays, at Kentucky this weekend, at LSU, who, oh, by the way, is actually the second-place team in the SEC after what happened the other night in Lexington, and then home to Kentucky.
Don't forget at Ole Miss after LSU.
Sure. And they've got Vanderbilt, the rivalry game in there. That was certainly – that was one of the challenges they had in the 19-game winning streak, was coming here and trying to win at Memorial Gym. So all of a sudden, this stretch – gets pretty difficult for Tennessee. How they navigate it, I think, is going to really tell us what type of a team this is.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to take anything away from, because they're legit. But to your point, even the Big 12 SEC Challenge, for whatever reason, this is the one year where Bob Huggins and the Mountaineers are down. They're not a great – I mean, there's been West Virginia teams that have made runs to the Final Four. They've been that good. This is not one of those teams. And so they even got West Virginia in a year where they're kind of off this year. They're not the same West Virginia team that we've seen year in and year out. So I don't want to take anything away from them, but to your point, this is really, really – I mean, you're talking about in back-to-back Saturdays in Rupp Arena – and down in Baton Rouge against LSU. And then the following game after LSU is at Ole Miss. Then you play Kentucky again. Then you play Mississippi State, and you're at Auburn to close out the regular season. Like, we're going to know exactly
you're ramping
what
up
they
here.
Are, right, yeah. When they come here for the SEC Men's Tournament. We'll come back.
I was just going to say they've got to be March ready, and there's a lot on the line because they haven't wrapped up the SEC. It's 19 wins in a row, 11 in a row in the league. They're only a game up. So they've got to keep winning during this difficult stretch. And then for the NCAA tournament, right now they're in great position to be a one seed, maybe the number one overall seed when all is said and done. But you lose two or three of those games, you might be talking about a two seed, potentially even falling to a three seed. So they've got to keep it up. 19 wins hasn't been enough.
We'll come back. We'll talk to Buck Rising to wrap up the first hour, tell you what he has up his sleeve, and he may need your help. We'll tell you what we're talking about next on 102.5 The Game.
Aaron and Donick back here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Steve Lehman from News Channel 5 here. The room has opened up downstairs. So Darren McFarland heading down to get his pregame interview. You, can, of course, can hear that tonight, 6 o'clock, right here on 102.5 The Game, ahead of the Predators and Canadiens. At 7, Buck Rising, Tackling Music City podcast, joins us now on the phone. Buck, good to hear from you, my man. But you're not necessarily talking football this week. A very interesting event coming up Saturday at Nissan Stadium. Titans are part of this every year. The Polar Plunge with the Special Olympics taking place. And Mike Vrabel, very involved here. And now you are as well. Tell me what's up.
What's going on, Steve? I appreciate you letting me stop by and plug what we got going on this Saturday at Nissan Stadium.
You are always welcome. So what's going on? Are you getting wet as well here?
Yes, which is particularly worthy of donations, because the last time that I was in any kind of body of water, probably 4 years ago, my senior year spring break, because I don't swim, Steve, so I'm going to be wearing adult water wings when I take the polar plunge and probably
To
need to have...
What are those?
Adult water wings?
Yeah. What are those?
They're bigger versions of the things that you put on toddlers who can't swim.
You're wearing floaties?
I am. I'm 25 years old, Steve, and I can't swim.
All right. Well, you're right. People definitely need to donate now. I will look this up immediately because that's worth the price of admission right there.
And no doubt about it. So what essentially has happened, Steve, is you know that Coach Vrabel has a unique relationship, we'll call it, with Teresa Walker of the Associated Press. He essentially challenged Teresa and the rest of us who are a part of the Titans media core on a day-to-day basis to do the polar plunge with him to help raise funds for the Special Olympics of Tennessee. It's a cause that's really close to Coach Vrabel's heart, one that I'm happy to be a part of in the 5 days that we've had that link active that you can donate to or at least share so we can get some more eyeballs on. The Titans fans and people who have responded on social media have raised almost $15,000. So I'm incredibly grateful to the people that we have asked to help us as we raise these funds and to support a really cool cause, and mostly to come out and laugh at me and all of my shame when I jump into the water and likely scream like a small child and then need somebody to pull me from the water because I won't be able to do it myself.
Yeah, so be honest here. How terrified are you of, one, getting in the water, and, two, freezing to death?
The freezing to death, like, if I had to pick one way to go, that sounds the least painful. The drowning thing is something that causes me much, much greater trepidation, Steve, because I'm telling you, like, this is something that's a real thing for me. Like, I'm happy to raise money. I'm happy to show up and support the cause. I'm happy to be loud and spread the word wherever I can, but I am not thrilled about having to do this jump. And the fact that I've been publicly pressured on social media by the Titans head coach is only going to serve to emasculate me further, more so than when I get those disparaging looks from him when I ask dumb questions at press conferences.
And he's not a particularly active guy on social media. So for him to come out and call you out specifically for this purpose, I mean, this is a higher calling, really.
Oh, I mean, no question. And Mike will be on with us on Tackling Music City Live on Friday night to talk about a little more about what the cause of the Special Olympics means to him. So we'll look forward to chatting with Coach Vrabel then about it. But yes, this is how you know that Mike Vrabel really, really cares about this, because otherwise he wouldn't give us the time of day on social media. Right. And now at least we know that he's on social media and he's keeping tabs on us and that he's just waiting to emerge from the shadows for the opportunity to shame me for money.
I think the last thing he posted on social media before this was congratulating his son Tyler on graduating, like last May or something like that. And then he went all in on the Special Olympics storm here this week and in getting you involved.
Yes, and getting all of us involved. It won't just be me making the jump. Again, 11:15 is when we'll be doing that this Saturday at Nissan Stadium, Lot R, is where you can come out and enjoy the festivities and see all the fun that we're going to have. Teron Davenport of ESPN.com. I know Paul and John Glennon are having their group make the jump as well to kind of fold it in to Mike Vrabel's larger cause. And so hopefully the fact that we will be there in solidarity will make me feel less ashamed of what is going to happen as soon as I hit that water. But as soon as I come up clawing at the air like I'm literally dying, Steve, only to find out that I can probably stand up in the water that we're going to be jumping into, it's going to end poorly for me either way. But hopefully it's enough to get some comedy and to raise some money for the cause.
Buck, I'm going to Lexington on Saturday for Tennessee Kentucky, so unfortunately I will not be able to be there with you, although I can also tell you that there's nothing that I dislike more in life than being freezing cold. So maybe I'm not actually all that sorry. But for the people out there listening right now who think it is, and I certainly am one of them, this is a incredible cause. So I'm glad all of you guys and Coach Vrabel are doing it and raising awareness and support to get people to hopefully donate in even larger numbers than the $15,000 already to help benefit Special Olympics. Where do people need to go besides 11:15 Saturday in Lot R to try to put their money behind what is a great cause?
Polar Plunge TN Polarplunge.com is the website where you can register to do the Polar Plunge if you would like to participate yourself. You can also find the link to donate there as well. You can find our specific link to dunk Coach Vrabel, because Mike's making the jump too, along with the Titans Media Corps. So you can find that link. I have it pinned to the top of my profile on Twitter, at Buck Rising, and I know Mike's got it on his Twitter profile as well, at Coach Vrabel 50. Again, one of the more unique situations that we have here in Nashville, a head coach on social media and a quarterback who's not. I always find that funny.
Yeah, it'll be fantastic. Okay, I'm not going to be too hard on you, Buck. We do not need a video of you screaming like a girl, but we do definitely need you to have a picture of you in floaties on Saturday. So that is a must out of this.
Without question, Steve, our wonderful social media team at ESPN 102.5 The Game will be there to document this. So not only will you get pictures of the Water Wings, you will get the video of me screaming like a small child as I make the plunge.
All right. Well, Buck, we appreciate you doing this. Best of luck out there and Godspeed.
Thanks, Steve. Always fun to talk to you.
Buck Rising, Tackling Music City podcast. Does great work there, and this is absolutely a great endeavor. So check it out online, on a social media for sure, and donate for a good cause for the Special Olympics here of Middle Tennessee. That'll wrap up hour number one here of Darren and Donick. When we come back, a little college basketball talk. We'll visit with Lipscomb head coach Casey Alexander after their big game last night, and also move into the Predators and Canadians, Lindsey Rowley, straight ahead as well. Hour number two of Darren and Donick is next. This is ESPN Radio 102.5 The Game.